Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Jobs are looking good, inflation and consumer sentiment are looking better, but really, what to make of this weird economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, August 12th. Good to have you along. A data point to get us started today. U.S. import prices, that is the prices for things we buy from other countries, fell 1.4% in July, the first drop since December of last year. It's the latest in a run of cautiously optimistic financial data out recently on jobs, wholesale and retail prices, and, as we're going to hear a bit later, consumer sentiment. Joining us to help sort it all out, a couple of our regular experts, Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and Neela Richardson from ADP. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Catherine, let's start with you and these CPI numbers that came out this week, plus those import and producer prices. Is it safe to start talking about peak inflation yet?
I think it is never safe to make any sort of projection as stark as transitory or peak or what have you. I think that's one of the lessons of the last couple of years. Yeah. But I will say that this was a relatively welcome report in that the decrease in energy prices wiped out the energy prices and airfares, I should say, wiped out the increase from some other painful categories like rent and food. So if the decline in energy prices continues, then yes, I think there's reason to hope that the, you know, close to 10% inflation numbers that we were seeing recently are in the rearview mirror. But never say never. I've learned my lesson. We've gotten a lot of bad luck in the last couple of years. Hopefully we're on a better path now.
Yeah, and I think all economists got a nice dose of humility. Neela, do you think, how hopeful for this to be kind of maybe the beginning of an easing of this, do you think we should be given the data that we've seen so far?
Well, there's always hope. But I think the discussion is transitioning from how high will inflation go to how long this abnormally high inflation will last. When will this heat wave break? And I think we're still ways away. If you look at all of the numbers, but strip away energy and food prices, which did accelerate last month by quite a bit. But if you strip those two away, what you see is that some of the drivers of inflation, like shelter costs that Catherine mentioned, are still present and are unlikely to just disappear. So while we may see some relief from energy prices, we know those prices are volatile and could show up again in higher inflation if they are triggered by another global shock, which we can't rule.
Well, and that kind of brings me to my next point, and Neela, I'll stay with you, is we all felt these prices going up. But even if these inflation pressures start to ease in the sort of macro sense, how long until you and I actually start feeling it get better?
Well, we may not, because once prices go up, that's the whole point. They stay up, unless you have something called deflation, which triggers a whole bunch of other issues. But they stay up. So these price increases are baked in a lot of parts of the economy. They're not going down. The hope is that they'll just slow in their rate of increase, which is totally different. And even if you look at energy prices, like at a time when people just want to be near a working air conditioner, electricity prices went up. At a time when you just want a cold drink, beverage prices went up. So there are some significant details within those headline numbers in which people are really feeling the pain of both higher prices and prices that have risen even recently.
So then, Catherine, what does this latest batch of data in all these different areas that we got this week mean for all of our recession worries?
Well, I think the tenor of the discussion about recession risks a few weeks ago was approaching like an assumption of inevitability, right? I mean, you may even remember Biden and some other White House officials saying over and over again on TV, a recession is not inevitable. A recession is not inevitable. And they were saying that because people were assuming that. And I think that, again, there's some reason for hope now that not only might inflationary pressures come down a little bit, even if, as you know, Neela points out, that doesn't mean prices will fall. It just means price growth will slow. Given that, it may mean that we are not destined for a recession, that the Fed may, in fact, reach its coveted soft landing. We had a really strong jobs report recently. We have seen the overall inflation numbers moving in the right direction, even if there's some, you know, concerning numbers under the hood there. So all of that put together suggests that, you know, a recession obviously isn't ruled out, but maybe things don't look quite as dire as they did a month or so ago, when it looked like month after month, the inflation numbers were coming in much hotter than anyone predicted. And it looked like the Fed was going to have to be super, super aggressive for a while in order to get those price pressures under control. So again, there's so much uncertainty, it's hard to know. But I do think that there's a little bit more optimism in the forecasts today as a result of some of this data we've gotten in recently.
So as we're recording, the House is debating the Inflation Reduction Act, which, Catherine, I'm sure you and Neela both know, is also about taxes and healthcare and climate. But Catherine, you had a really interesting piece this week on one slice of the bill, the billions of dollars for the IRS, already a popular GOP talking point in opposition to the bill. What did you see in your reporting as to why the IRS might need these funds?
So I got to take a very rare tour of what's called the pipeline by which paper tax returns are processed. And I had heard stories about how archaic the IRS was, but I could not believe it until I got this tour. It was just like paper, 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 as far as the eye can see. Every available shelf, hallway, even the entire cafeteria was just clogged with backlogged paper returns, because the IRS right now has a backlog of over 10 million returns that it's still trying to process and get through the system. And this is because IRS has been systemically underfunded for many decades and is still using the same technology to process tax returns that it did in the 1970s. So part of how this money will be used is to upgrade and automate a lot of this process. I mean, some of it will go toward more enforcement. That's what most people have heard about. But a lot of it will also be used to modernize, which the IRS desperately needs.
Neela, I'll give you the last word on this. The Inflation Reduction Act, do you get a sense it's going to reduce inflation?
Not in the next month or two, no. But the hope of the act is that by spending now on investments that make the economy more productive, that will be the best defense against inflation in the future. So we do know that when an economy is more productive, prices tend to fall, not increase, and inflation is reined in. So if spending leads to more productivity in the economy, then we could see some good news in the future.
Neela Richardson of ADP and Catherine Rampell of The Washington Post, thank you both so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
On Wall Street Today, ending the week on an up note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One sign that consumers may be feeling a little better about the economy, as we mentioned, consumer sentiment ticked up slightly in August, according to the University of Michigan's monthly survey. The measure of how consumers feel about their personal finances and overall economic conditions had hit a record low in June when gas prices hit their peak. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more on this latest confidence boost.
Consumer spending makes up the bulk of the GDP, so it matters how people feel about the economy. And lately, there have been a lot of mixed messages, says Jennifer Lee, senior economist with BMO Capital Markets.
I cannot remember a time when it was so strange, the economic tea leaves that we're seeing these days.
Lee says we've got inflation and talk of a potential recession to worry about, but the labor market is holding up. Wage growth is strong.
It's not like your garden variety recession where everything is going to hell in a handbasket.
And consumer sentiment is also a mixed bag. Joanne Chu, who directs the University of Michigan survey, says we're feeling a little better about our personal finances. But
in spite of this improvement, consumer sentiment remains extremely low relative to even just a year ago.
So the consumer went from anxious to still pretty cranky. But there's some good news.
People are feeling a bit more optimistic about the 12-month outlook for the economy, and this was largely coming from people with low and middle incomes.
And those are the people whose budgets are most sensitive to inflation.
I think it goes right back to what people are paying at the pump.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
Nothing plays a bigger role in shaping the collective psyche than the price of a gallon of gasoline,
which on average dipped below $4 a gallon this week for the first time since March. Right now, Zandi says even weak but improving consumer sentiment is a good sign.
That suggests they may have their hand on the bunker door, but they haven't gone in yet.
In other words, people haven't started to hunker down and pull back dramatically on spending. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Moving on to the teacher shortage we've been covering, to lure talent, reduce student absenteeism, and save a little money, hundreds of districts are trying something new, moving to four-day weeks. It can be a perk for teachers, but usually means a reduction in classroom time. And for many students, it comes at a time when they're already dealing with learning loss from being remote during the pandemic. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
The 900 students in Lathrop, Missouri, don't go to school on Mondays.
It's kind of the new Sunday.
New since 2010, when Lathrop adopted a four-day school week. Chris Fine is superintendent. He says the original intent was to save money by cutting down on the hours the district needed and had to pay support staff.
Cooks, custodians, bus drivers, even secretaries, they all work 32-hour weeks.
The district saves $125,000 per year, around 1.25% of its annual budget. That's on par with what most districts save. Fine says the students' days in the building are longer. They don't have half days, and snow days are made up by coming in on the odd Monday. So Fine says there hasn't been a reduction in class time.
Moving forward, was we were able to add hours of instruction to the school day. So we go Tuesday through Friday, basically 8 to 3:45.
Other districts also increase the length of the school day, but
many of them are not increasing it enough.
Paul Thompson is a professor of economics at Oregon State University. He says some districts are reducing instruction time by 5 hours each week, which in the wake of a couple years of remote learning is an especially big deal.
To do this effectively, you need to find a way to recapture that lost time.
Thompson says there are other effects too. Kids might not run around as much because they don't go to recess. And teenagers who are unsupervised have more time to be teenagery. Still, the vast majority of districts that go down to 4 days a week don't go back, like Newcastle Public Schools in central Oklahoma, where Melanie Howe is superintendent. For the last 6 years, they've taken Fridays off. They were actually in today, and Howe says people were not feeling it.
Folks are talking about their normal Friday errands that they would run that somebody else in their family will have to pick up this week.
Howe says teacher recruitment is one of the main reasons they've kept this policy in place.
We've had teacher candidates say that they chose us because of the extra day.
For parents who don't have that extra day off, Howe's district offers childcare for a fee. There's also evidence that in some places with four-day school weeks, mothers specifically work fewer hours. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's the inner need of the Greeks to host foreigners, travelers, and tourists.
Hospitality may just be their calling. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 424 points, 1.25%, to close at 33,761. The Nasdaq gained 267 points, almost 2.1%, to finish at 13,047. The S&P 500 was up 72 points, about 1.75%, to end at 4280. For the week, the Dow grew 2.9%, the Nasdaq improved 3%, and the S&P bumped up 3.2%. Savannah mentioned lower gas prices as one reason for improving consumer confidence. AAA says the average price of a gallon of regular is $3.97, down from more than $4 a week ago. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.84%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Like I was discussing with Neela and Catherine in the wrap at the top of the show, the Consumer Price Index showed that while inflation didn't go up in July, prices are still up about 8.5% year over year. And that's being felt by consumers and business owners. Which brings us to our latest installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Philip Rollins, also go by DJ Young Venom, and I own Offbeat here in Jackson, Mississippi. Offbeat is a alternative culture store. We've been in business for 8 years, and it's basically a combination of things. It's a record store, a comic book shop, a designer toy shop, and most importantly, it's a art gallery for young minority artists here in the area so they can showcase and sell their work. The backbone that, I guess, in short, would stabilize the store is records. And it got a big, big push during COVID. I guess people just bought record players and started organizing their collections and just, you know, started adding to it. So me being a DJ for so long, if I don't give good recommendations, then I can't say that I'm a good DJ. And especially when people come to the store, they'd be like, oh, you have this. And I'm like, yeah, I know what, you know, what moves the crowd or what people will like. Okay, so inflation is gut-punching my business right now. I rely heavily on selling used records more than new records, but there are certain things that you just cannot find used. The biggest demand right now is 90s R&B, 90s hip-hop.
The days on the boulevard are lended. We used to kick routines and the presence was fitting. It was I, the abstract.
And me, the five-footer. I kicks the mad style, so step off the frankfurter.
Yo, Fife, you remember
and
that.
And you're just not going to find that in good condition. Like so I have to rely on reissues. And some of these reissues just get to be up there, whereas years ago, they probably would have been $20, $25. To now, we're looking at like $35, $40, $45, $50. You know, I wish the prices would go down. I hope they go down if more plants open up. Hopefully, I'll find that out in the future because the demand is up there. The supply is kind of low. But like I said, the records are the biggest thing that jumped up in price. Everything else has stayed pretty the same. Even with the Japanese import toys, I think they've jumped up maybe $5. But that's it. The business is able to stay afloat. We are supported through a really good community here. I have a lot of people that actually just want to come to the shop and they just help out, whether it's like throwing out boxes. There have been like days where I've just been like stressed out, but I've worked through it and I think I finally hit a groove for a balance for the shop.
That was Philip Rollins selling records, toys, and more at Offbeat in Jackson, Mississippi. This series only works with your help. You can tell us how your economy is going at marketplace.org/myeconomy. So Some of the pandemic changes to the economy are likely to stay with us for the foreseeable future. Lots of delivery services, remote work, and changes to the way many of us vacation. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, it could be hard to find somewhere peaceful, especially at popular tourist destinations. Then tourist spots were empty for months or years. Now, as travel picks up again, some vacationers still want some space between them and other travelers. And tourist boards are increasingly happy to help, even promoting quiet spots to international tourists. The BBC's Victoria Craig went to the Greek island of Tinos to explore one of them.
This place has everything you might expect: iconic whitewashed buildings with deep blue window frames, and something you might not expect. While Mykonos and Santorini often steal the spotlight, this lesser-known Cyclades destination is garnering its own attention, with traditional industry playing a starring role. And the leading lady in this story is cheesemaker Agela Rugeri.
Hi.
When we arrive at her farm, she's carefully wrapping cheesecloth around the last mounds of fresh curd from the day's production.
I'm the owner of a small industry of making cheese. The milk is from my own cows, and I'm making traditional cheese that people used to make since the old days.
The cheese she makes, Malathuni and Kariki, come from old family recipes.
I remember myself when I was a little girl sleeping and listening to the milk dripping into the bucket. Cheese making was in our homes.
She and her husband started the business with just one pair of cows during the country's debilitating debt crisis in the early 2010s. Over the years, it's grown into an income they can rely on.
Here in Tinos, I sell to many places. It's mostly butcher shops, shops with traditional products, and restaurants. Also, there are private citizens who come here and buy cheese as a gift when they go back to Athens.
One of the few clients Angela has agreed to sell to is Spyros Bellis, a restaurateur. He says he specifically sought her out because she's a small local producer, and that has been a draw both for residents and tourists alike.
I think the most important thing for the customers, especially the tourists, even if they are from Greece or from all over the world, the best thing to do as a tourist is to discover treasures that the place has.
The pickup in tourism he's seen on the island over the past few years has been good for business, but he worries about the long-term impact.
Of course, I want more tourist people to come to our island. The problem is that if you have a lot of visitors every year, it's difficult to keep the traditions.
Indeed, there is potential for tourism to grow. While the latest data show in 2021 more than 18 million people vacationed in Greece, visitor numbers are more than 34% below 2019 levels. To boost them, the nation's tourism minister, Vasilis Kakilias, points to new flight routes from the U.S. and a broader strategy for promoting lesser-known islands.
The campaign is Greece. If you come even once, you will want to stay forever. Yes, of course, it's about Mykonos and Santorini and Corfu and Crete, but so many other destinations.
He argues that spreading visitor numbers across destinations will help reduce the over-tourism problem that plagued so many of the world's popular places before the pandemic. As for getting locals in less frequented locations on board with the plan, Minister Kakilias says,
go meet the Greeks. You will understand Greek hospitality. It's not a six-star hotel or great luxury. It's the inner need of the Greeks to host foreigners, travelers, and tourists and show them a great time.
Cheesemaker Agela Rugeri reiterates it's tradition that makes Tinos so special. And while there's a feeling of openness to welcome visitors, there's not a rush to export its uniqueness.
Look, it would be nice for the cheese to stay in Tinos, because when someone comes to Tinos and tries it, he will have the taste. Then he will try it again in Athens and his mind will go back to Tinos.
Whether for tradition or hospitality, open expanses or secluded coves, there's something that keeps tourists coming back for more. In Tinos, Greece, I'm the BBC's Victoria Craig for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today on one element of the pandemic economy that doesn't seem to have had quite the same longevity as our travel preferences, the at-home workout. Exercise equipment maker Peloton told employees today it will cut about 780 jobs, close some stores, and increase prices on some equipment. According to CNBC, it's all an attempt to cut cost and return to profitability, because once people could get out of their homes, they pretty much did. Here's your moment of economic context. It's a busy day for politics heading into the weekend. What with the climate, tax, healthcare bill likely on its way to becoming law, and the continuing fallout of the raid on Mar-a-Lago. Of course, all this is happening in the run-up to the midterm elections, where ad spending is on track to break records again. According to the Wesleyan Media Project, the volume of political ads is up more than 25% compared to this point in the 2018 midterms, and the money spent so far? Just under $1 billion. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you Monday, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.